over the past 20 years, we have seen some hopeless situations. But back in 2010, it was all over the news that there was a mining accident in Chile. There were 33 miners who would be trapped in that mine for 69 days. I can't even begin to imagine what it must have been like for those miners. You know, maybe the first day or two, they had the hope of being rescued. Maybe after the first week or so, they still had hope. But after 69 days, I wonder how hopeless it must have felt. To be trapped in a mine, not to have any light, not be sure if you could, how much longer you could survive without any resources, without food, and without some of the things to keep you warm as they were underground. I'm sure for many, they may have thought that they'd never see the light of day again. And it was just a few years ago, something very similar happened as a coach would take a few soccer players into a cave in Thailand. Little did they know that there would be an unexpected flash flood and the water would rise and cover the entrance to the cave and would keep coming in as they would have to continue to climb higher within the cave to stay out of the waters. Again, another hopeless situation. They didn't go into that cave planning to be there for multiple days. They knew they had limited supplies. Yet they would make it out. Yet there would be some who would come together, a team of divers that would make, that would stage oxygen, that would make all the preparations, and would bring the coach and the children out of that cave safely. And even though they thought and may have felt that they were in a hopeless situation, their lives were safe. I have to wonder, with all that's gone on in the past 9 months, if some of you don't feel hopeless. This is going to be a year that goes down in the history books. You cannot turn on the television without having a constant reminder of COVID. Each day we're given a number of cases and a number of deaths that are taking place both in our state and nationally. We've seen division take place in our country more so than I've ever seen in my 50 years of existence. Division over whether or not to wear a mask. Division over whether or not the virus is serious or not serious, or if it's a political or not political. And there's so many things that are going on. And people want you to feel stupid if you wear a mask, and people say you're foolish if you don't. Not only have we seen division in the COVID, in the area of COVID, but we see it in the issue of social injustice. There is a division taking place in our country. And the reality is, it is true. People have been mistreated. But why do we have to pick a side? The Bible makes it clear. We're all created in God's image. The Bible makes it clear. All lives matter. Why do we have to pick a side? We need to treat each other and love each other, as the Bible says. But yet there has been a great division in our country. And then there's the political division that is taking place. You know, we are entering into a week that may go down in the history books. There is more tension surrounding the election, more tension surrounding what's going to take place on Tuesday than most have ever seen in their lives. Cities are boarding up their windows in expectation of what may unfold. Then you tune in and watch the news, and I'd almost advise you not to do so this week. You're giving a sense, a constant sense of hopelessness. A constant reminder of all the things that are going on. And the reality is, how many of you would just love to go back 365 days ago? When there was an excitement. The holidays are coming. Thanksgiving's just around the corner. Christmas shopping, holidays, getting together with family. You know, there's not quite as much excitement right now. Some people may not travel to see family because they're worried about COVID and travel and things that are going on. Others, there's uncertainty. I know we have some people who are waiting in Ohio to come down to Florida until after the election to see what's going to happen because they feel safer staying put where they about church, as hopeless as it may appear, as Christians, we have hope. As Christians, hopeless should not be part of our vocabulary. You and I serve a God of hope. Jesus Christ is our living hope. The question is, how can we keep the events of our day from pulling us down into a feeling of hopelessness? How do we keep a joyful attitude despite what is going on? And I pray that we can answer these questions as we continue on in our study of 1 Samuel this morning. So as we continue on, we're going to see that the nation of Israel is to enter into a time that is worse than what you and I are experiencing today. As we look at chapter 4, we're going to learn, hopefully learn from some of the mistakes that were made. As we continue on in the book, we're going to see that God is faithful to keep His word. God is faithful to keep the covenant that He made with Israel, the covenant that He made with Abraham. Same is true for you and I today. We serve the same faithful God. Just a little review before we dig into chapter 4. In the last few weeks, we've seen that there is corruption within the priesthood of Israel. Eli and his sons have become gluttons. They're eating portions of the food that belong to the people. They're eating portions of the food that are to be sacrificed unto God. Eli's sons are having sexual relationships with women outside of the tabernacle. Really, they have taken on some of the practices of the Canaanites. This would be a normal action with the Canaanites outside of the temples. There would be temple prostitutes and all kinds of immoral actions taking place. And here we see this taking place around the tabernacle. It truly is a disgrace to God. And both a prophet of God and Samuel have revealed to Eli that God is not going to allow these sins to go unpunished, that God is going to deal with them and deal with them harshly. And it's as we look at chapter 4, we are going to see that these prophecies are fulfilled. We look at our Bibles in chapter 4 of 1 Samuel, if we look at the second half of verse 1 and 2, we see that Israel is defeated by the Philistines. Follow along, read. Now Israel went outside to battle against the Philistines, and encamped beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Ephek. Then the Philistines put themselves in battle array against Israel. And when they joined battle, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men of the army in the field. And this is not the first encounter that we have seen Israel have with the Philistines. Remember in the book of Judges, Samson would be battling against the Philistines. They were an enemy of Israel. And honestly, Israel's history with the Philistines can actually be traced all the way back to the book of Genesis. In Genesis chapter 21, verse 32, we can read about the Philistines. And God would continue to use them to bring discipline to the nation of Israel. In fact, in the book of 1 and 2 Samuel, the Philistines are mentioned roughly 150 times. We'll see later on in this chapter, God had used the Philistines, and some of the Israelites had actually been enslaved and become slaves to the Philistines. Very well may be why this battle is taking place, but in this passage, we see the troops are gathered. We see that Israelites set up camp in Ebenezer and the Philistines in Ephek. And basically, these must have been cities on each side on the line between Israel and the Philistine territory. And we see that Israel they're defeated quickly. We're told that they lost 4,000 and they retreated. Now, 4,000 is a pretty significant number of people, especially in the days of hand-to-hand combat. It wasn't like they had landmines and bombs and tanks. They were out there fighting each other with sword and shield. 4,000, that's more than we lost on 9/11 in the Twin Towers. More than I believe we lost during Pearl Harbor. Left Israel making their way back to camp, wondering why they had been defeated, trying to come up with a plan, how they could fix it, how they could win, how they could defeat the Philistines. And we see that in all their human wisdom, they decide to take the Ark of the Covenant in the battle. So when the people had come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh to us. Then when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies." In a lot of ways, I believe this verse, verse 3, reveals a lot about Israel's current spiritual condition. So the elders ask the question, why has the Lord defeated us? Which is a good question to ask. The problem is, they don't recognize why the Lord has chosen to defeat them. The Lord has chosen to defeat them because they have sinned, because they have done what is right in their own mind, because they've allowed corruption to take place in the priesthood, because they've been involved in idol worship. And they are so caught up in the Canaanite culture that they're blaming God, but they're not looking to the real problem, and that is that they have sinned. If you remember in the book of Judges, often when this would happen, often when they were taken into captivity, there would be that moment of supplication, that moment when they would repent of their sins and they would ask God for deliverance. Notice all of that is missing here. What do we see? We lost. How can we fix the problem? And the solution is to take the Ark of the Covenant. Boy, this is kind of scary. The Ark of the Covenant really was a sacred part of their worship, a sacred part of the tabernacle. It was to be kept in the Holy of Holies. The priest was only allowed to enter into that spot once a year. God was very specific as how it was to be handled. It was to be covered by the Levites. It was to be carried by poles by the Levites. All kinds of specific instruction about the ark. And here it's like, let's go get it and take it into battle. It's almost as if they see the ark. Something that they can use in a way to manipulate God to get the outcome that they desire. We continue on in verses 4 and 5. We see that indeed they go and get the ark and they bring it into camp. It says, "So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring there the ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts who dwells between the cherubim. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the ark of the covenant back. And when the ark of the covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the earth shook. Indeed, they would go and retrieve the ark." And we see there that there's this huge shout that takes place. There is some excitement. Although this is their idea, although they've not inquired of God, although they have not repented of their sins, they feel that their plan is so, they're so confident in their plan, so confident the ark is going to bring them victory, that there is a shout that is so loud that it shakes the ground. Well, I have heard some things that were loud that will shake the ground, but I don't know that I've ever heard people's voices. I have to imagine it would be something similar to a football game where the home crowd, sometimes they'll say it's so loud that the quarterback and the players on the field can't even hear each other because the crowd is so loud. It had to be that kind of shout. In fact, we'll see it was so loud that the Philistines heard it in their camp. As the Philistines heard it, fear spread amongst them, verses 6 to 8. Now when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, What does the sound of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean? Then they understood that the ark of the Lord had come into the camp. So the Philistines were afraid. So they said, God has come into the camp. And they said, woe to us. For such a thing has never happened before. Woe to us. Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? They are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. There is some fear spreading to the camp of the Philistines. Notice they use that phrase, woe to us. That's a phrase, when it's used in the Hebrews, it basically means, when they say woe, it's like, I'm done, I'm a goner, I can't survive this. There's great fear, and they remember all the way back when God delivered the Israelites from Egypt. This has been more than 300 years ago. And yet, the story still remains. It's still remembered. So God brought them out. He destroyed Egypt with the plagues. He brought this nation out from under the slavery of the Egyptians and defeated Pharaoh and his mighty armies. And it's a valid fear. Somewhere along the line, someone within the camp, as we'll see in verse 9, comes up and says, no, we, and he encourages them. He encourages them to stand and fight. If we read verse 9, we simply read the following. Be strong and conduct yourselves like men, you Philistines. That you do not become servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight. And this must have been one of the greatest motivational speeches ever given. Now, how can we go from woe is us, we're going to be killed, we're not going to make it, we're going to die, to someone come along and say, listen, it's time to put on your big boy pants here. We can do this. We need to fight like men. We don't need to be cowards. Look, we just defeated 4,000 of them in the last battle. Why do we think this is going to be any different? And the reason I say it must have been one of the greatest motivational speeches ever given is because they do. Man up. They go into battle. Despite the fact that the Israelites have the ark, they would choose to go into battle. And we see that Israel is defeated and the ark is captured in verses 10 through 10 and 11. So the Philistines fought and Israel was defeated and every man fled to his tent. There was a very great slaughter. And there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. Also, the ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. What are some of the words here? Great slaughter. Eli's sons were killed, and I think the most devastating thing of the day is the ark was captured by Eli. You remember last week as God spoke to Samuel, he said there was going to be an event that took place that caused all the ears of the people in Israel to tingle. This is it. This is that event, the event when people will hear the news of it, they're going to be in disbelief. They're not going to believe it. How could such a thing happen? A messenger makes his way back to Shiloh and reports the news in verses 12 and 13. It says that a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line the same day and came to Shiloh with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. When he came, there was Eli sitting on a seat by the wayside watching. His heart trembled through the ark of God. When the man came into the city, he told it, and all the city cried out. Messenger makes his way back. I have to believe the people were waiting with anticipation, but I believe they were waiting with anticipation, expecting of the word of victory and how the ark had saved him and how they had defeated the Philistines, but that's not the word that came back. We even are told that Eli, he's sitting on the edge of the seat. He's anxious. He's anxious because he knows the arch has never been taken out of his head. He's anxious because he's concerned that something might happen. Something, and indeed something did happen. Something that left the city in mourning. The plan of the elders has failed. The messenger makes his way to Eli. Eli asks questions about the battle in verses 14 and 16. When Eli heard the noise and the outcry, he said, "What does the sound of this tumult mean?" And the man came quickly and told Eli. Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were so dim that he could not see. Eli hears the noise spread throughout Shiloh. He knows it's not good news. We're told, as we've already seen in the book of Samuel, that he no longer can see. We're told that he's 98 years old. And as the young man arrives and identifies himself, Eli says, "What's taking place? What happened?" In verse 17, we see the report. So the messenger answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there's been a great slaughter among the people. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God has been dead." Where the messenger simply responds with three facts. It was a great slaughter. You know, I think it would have been devastating to lose 4,000. Now we're talking about 30,000. Not only has there been a great slaughter, Eli, your sons have died. Again, I don't know that this would have been much surprise to Eli as a prophet. The man of God said, "Your sons will die on the same day." But I think the most devastating news is that the ark has been set. And we'll see that as we look at verse 18. As Eli receives this news, he falls off his chair and dies. Verse 18, it happened when he made mention of the ark of God, that Eli fell off the seat backwards by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. The man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel for 40 years. We're told, you know, and you would think, to hear all the other events of the day, the great slaughter, and the fact that his sons had died, that would be bad news. You might fall off his chair at the beginning. But it was only when mention of the ark was made that Eli falls off his chair. And think about this. Why some of the description? Why is it so detailed? Why does it make the point of saying Eli was heavy? I think it's to point out that he was part of the gluttony of his sons. So really, he was receiving the penalty for his sins, the penalty for overlooking the things that had happened. The reality is, Eli would be remembered as the judge, as the priest, who overlooked the sins of his sons, who allowed the ark to be taken captive. Oddly enough, Eli's daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, gives birth as a result of the news. She would instantly go into labor, and we read about it in verses 19 and 20. So now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, and his child, due to be delivered. And when she heard the news that the ark of God was captured, and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed herself and gave birth, for her labor pains came upon her. About the time of her death, the woman she stood by said to her, "Do not fear, beautiful son." The news is so tragic. And again, notice what it says. It's not really the news of Eli and the news of her husband, but it's the news that the ark was captured that would cause her to go into labor. I mean, this had to be news that as a nation, as a town of Shiloh, as they heard it, would have been so devastating that people grieved. I mean, they were physically sick as a result of hearing this news. And to the point that this lady would go into labor. As I've looked through this, I've tried to decide that she dies, she gives labor, does she live? It's a little confusing as we continue on, but it appears that she has died, but yet we see that the boy would be named in the next verses, and we see that Israel is left feeling hopeless. But the chapter concludes, and we look at verses 21 and 22, that then she named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has passed because of the father-in-law and her husband." And she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has passed." So I'd say if she did die giving childbirth, she was able to utter these words before she passed. And the words that she uttered are words of hopelessness. The glory of God has left. The ark is gone. There's no hope. What are we going to do? We're doomed. The very thing that represented the presence of God, the very thing that was representation of the covenant that had been made with Israel, is now in the hands of the enemy. There's a lot of bad news that takes place in one day. Maybe a little similar to some of the things we're experiencing today. Things of nature that are taking place. Wildfires out of west that cannot be controlled. I believe we may have just broken the record for the most named storm during the hurricane season. We're dealing with a pandemic, worldwide pandemic. But when it comes to the things of nature, I don't claim to be a prophet, but God has allowed it to happen, and I wonder if he's not trying to get people's attention. But I believe there's also the other things that we're dealing with, the division. Our nation is more divided than it's ever been. And all this is bad stuff, but I would say much like the 30,000 casualties and the death of Eli and his sons, all the things that I have mentioned to you this morning are not the worst thing that's happened to our country. I believe the worst thing that has happened to our country is very similar to the fact that the ark was kept and that our nation has turned its back on God. Reality is churches like ours are struggling today because people have no interest in hearing the truth of God's word. Our nation has turned its back on God to where we have a generation who believes he does not exist. And I believe it has left us facing a difficult time, much like Israel was facing in chapter 2. The question is, where do we go from here? What do we do? Clearly, we have entered uncharted waters when it comes to the United States and the church. We have a country that's becoming biblically illiterate. They have lost touch with God. They have little to no tolerance for the church or Christianity. How do we overcome this? And I think one of the first things we need to do is, as a church, we need to identify the root problem. You know, what was the problem with Israel? The problem was that they had sinned. The problem was that they were involved in idol worship. The problem was that they hadn't repented from their sin. You remember, as we're going through the book of Judges, we would see this cycle. They would sin. God would send someone along, and they would be put into slavery. As they were put into slavery, eventually it would lead to supplication, and then the Savior would come, and salvation would come, and then they would have silence, and they would go through this cycle, but all of a sudden they got stuck in the sin part, and there's no supplication, and there's nothing going on, and there's no salvation taking place, or at least it would appear. I think the same is true for us as a country. us as Christians, we need to look to the root problem. The root problem isn't that people can't get along. The root problem isn't that there are some bad police officers out there. The root problem is not have to deal with race. The root problem is sin. The root problem is that we've turned, as a nation, we have turned our back on God. The problem is often we try to fix the symptoms. We think that if we can write some laws that will fix it, or we can write our congressmen, or we can train the police to do a better job, or we can do this, or we can do that. None of that stuff's really going to fix the problem. God is the one who needs to fix the problem, and therefore I say if we identify the problem, we need to get on our knees and pray. We need to be asking for boldness to share the gospel message. Pray that God will give us wisdom as a church in how to reach lost people. People who don't want to hear the gospel message. How do we reach them? We need to pray for opportunities and wisdom on how to use the resources that God has blessed us with. So I am a firm believer that God can use a few people to make a significant difference to his people. Look at the disciples. I don't have to take long. You think as a church, not convinced by looking at it. In the hands of God, we can make a difference. We have to stop trying to fix the symptoms and we need to focus on the truth of God. We also need to make sure not only that we identify the problem, we need to make sure that we're not part of the problem. Talk about the sin cycle of Israel. Sometimes I wonder if we're not more of the problem than we are the solution. And that was the case with Eli and his sons. They were to be the solution. They were to be the spiritual leaders. They were to be the ones that they should have been the ones to inquire of God and say, should we go to battle against the Philistines? And when Eli and his sons heard the news, we want to take the ark, and he said, no, wait a minute. Maybe we should ask God first. We need to make sure we're not caught up in the same sin cycle. We need to examine our lives and see where we need to change. And the reality is we all sin. And there are times we willfully sin knowing that we shouldn't. The reality is we need to strive to be obedient to God's word. And I think if nothing else, if we simply follow the two commandments given by God, the two greatest commandments, if we would choose to love God and choose to love others, I think it's just a simple difference that following those two commandments can make. If we choose to love our neighbor despite how many political signs they have in their lives. If we choose to love the neighbors no matter how late they play loud music. If we choose to love them no matter how fast they drive past their home. Choose to love them despite their sexual preference or gender identity. Choose to love them even if they're involved in political corruption. The reality is God has told us we are to love everyone. And if we choose not to love them, we are guilty of sin. And it can hinder our ability to be like God. And I would say to you this morning, church, we need to make up our mind to do this, and we need to make up our mind to do it now. The reality is this next week is going to be very trying. no matter who wins this election, there are going to be those who are upset. And we need to make sure we respond to them. Make sure we respond to love, no matter what names may be used of you, depending on who you voted for. We need to respond to love, regardless of what is said, both in speech and written word on social media. We need to make sure that we respond to what is in God's mind, despite what is happening. I think last but not least, we want to make sure that we can maintain our hope in all this and trust God. Think about what we've seen in this chapter. The Israelites are defeated in battle. Immediately, they go to their own wisdom to fix the problem. As a result, the ark will be taken into the enemy's hands. And I think, as I said this morning, I think they were viewing the ark kind of as a good luck charm. After all, God did use it in that way when they took drove out the inhabitants of the land. As they would go around Jericho, they would march around the city with the Ark of the Covenant. In fact, many believe that the shout that was given in the camp when the Ark came in would have been similar to the shout that was given when the walls of Jericho fell. But the reality is, God wasn't behind it. It wasn't God's will. It didn't save them that day. And I wonder if sometimes as Christians, we're not guilty of doing the same thing. We find ourselves in difficult situations. So all of a sudden, we decide to be more faithful in our church attendance, more faithful in our Bible reading, more faithful in our prayer. And all these things are good, and I think all of them help us grow in a relationship with God. But it's not a way to manipulate God to make our circumstances better. The reality is, God is sovereign. There's nothing that we do that will change His plan. And I would say this, He already knows the outcome of Tuesday. He knows who's going to be elected. And my God, if it's the person you don't want to be elected, we have to believe that God has a purpose. Romans 13 would say all authorities have been put in place by God. And that means that the candidate that you don't like is put in office, God has a plan. And we may scratch our heads and say, how can this be part of His plan? God isn't a God where if you do this, 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 and this, He's guaranteed to do that. That's kind of the way your life is, isn't it? I mean, think about it. If you struggle with weight like I have, there's all kinds of diets out there. If you do this, and right now keto is very popular, bless your heart if you can do the keto diet. I love my carbs. But the reality is, you know, the idea of you cut carbs and do this, and you lose weight, and it actually works. I've seen people do it. Same thing when it comes to finances. You know, if you do this, and you know, we have people that have all kinds of great budgeting plans. Dave Ramsey is one of those. You know, you pay off all your debts, you put back an emergency fund, you put back enough for 6 months worth of this, and then you start paying tax for everything, and there's all these wonderful plans. And if you follow this stuff, you can be debt-free and have money. For some reason, in our minds, we want God to be that way. We want to be able to know that we can do this, this, and this, and have an expected outcome. And I'll be honest with you, the only thing that we can do that with is to trust Jesus Christ to save us from the sins and that we have. Other than that, God is not a God who can be manipulated, and we have to trust Him. No matter what happens in our life. But I wish I could tell you in 2 days that everything's going to be better. The reality is the future of our nation is pretty uncertain. I can tell you this. I think about the Israel, it must seem pretty uncertain.
earthly chapter. God will keep his covenant. God will remain faithful. Eventually, Jesus Christ will come from the cloud and do this last cross. I think this is a reminder to us this morning that we have a faithful God, one that we can trust. He will keep his word. And if nothing else, it's the fact that you and I will place our faith in Jesus Christ and have the assurance of eternal life. That And for that reason, you and I can hold our heads high. We can live a life of hope and not despair. And I believe, as I said this morning, God can use a few people, a small church in the middle of Cape Coral, Florida, to make a difference. We need to make sure we don't lose focus. We need to make sure that we keep our eyes on Him and not the events that are unfolding around us. Make sure that we do what the board in the foyer says. Let's make sure that we keep our focus on knowing Him and making Him known. There are a lot of people who need to know Him. And since we do that, I am a firm believer that God will use us to make a difference. In order for that to happen, we have to trust Him. And so, I believe we're going to go. I wish I could just get all of you to join me and we'd all commit to the offering. So we'd all be better for it. Some people are willing to commit. So whether we turn it off or not, we're going to do it. We need to make sure we respond to the Father. Father, I thank you again for this day. I thank you for the opportunity to have a church with you and study with you. And I pray that your church, our faith, your Christian